We often ask what replaces religion as a marker of identity in a country that's secularising. Politics is one avenue, education another. But psychiatrist Tanvir Ahmed worries that a growing number of Australians use mental health as a form of identity. He's contributed to a forthcoming book. It's called Beneath the Southern Cross, Looking for Australia in the 21st Century. And in a timely warning, he says violence can be the darkest form of the search for belonging. Tanvir, what do the terrorists really want?
Combination of belonging, some sort of riposte, some sort of resolution to a sense of humiliation or shame that often overlaps with any sort of violence, but certainly in terrorism. And there's usually some version of a type of salvation. So there's a moral dimension also, where they're seeking some version of salvation, if you like, or a moral regeneration. So I think it's all of those things together.
But is that a personal sort of moral regeneration as opposed to a political or religious objective?
Primarily personal, yeah. Mm. But through the channel of the religious or the political.
Yeah. And how and why do some terrorists adopt the markers of religion, even if he or sometimes she is not really religious?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. But we're meaning-seeking creatures. Whatever actions we take, there'll be some sort of justification, you know, and these are in some of the most horrific acts that humans are capable of, and no different to a violent act that we might label as terrorism, where there'll be a justification, there'll be an outer marker. There's symbols. You know, we're full of symbols and myths in the way we behave as well. We're not entirely rational creatures. Acts of terrorism are no different, especially when it's a signal, when there's a performative collective component, right? And that's the difference between an act upon an individual solely. But when there's a performative and a broader component to the action, those symbols carry much greater meaning.
Yeah. You write that people can appear outwardly integrated, they can be materially successful, but they have a sense of self that is markedly at odds with their society. In those circumstances, we are not talking about a person who is deranged, because to have that kind of dual mindset, that requires cunning, that requires intelligence, doesn't it? These are not unbalanced people, are they?
That sort of comment does not apply just to terrorism. I think that's very much a modern trend, if you like. We can live in place, we can live in a certain geography. Our belonging can be totally devoid, totally disconnected from our physical space. You know, so many people are just connected entirely online, for example. So many different types of belonging, identity, value systems now can arise almost entirely divorced from your physical space.
Yeah. But if you are an intelligent person, intelligent enough to be a success in your society, what are the motivations for you wanting to blow it up, literally and metaphorically?
You know, a lot of people looked into this over the last 20, 25 years. And I think there is a general, if not a common consensus, there's a general view that it's been primarily about belonging, identity, humiliation. And then there's a certain group there where, as they become more and more distant from the mainstream, or perceive themselves to be more and more distant. Mm. So again, outwardly, they're playing the game, they're going through the motions, but psychologically, they feel more and more distant. And then they acquire a sense of belonging, much like cults, etc., in a slightly isolated way. And the stronger that aspect of belonging, it tightens, it magnifies. And at its worst, it can drive some sort of action.
Yeah.
And again, that's not limited to Islamic terrorism. That drives all sorts of deviant behaviour in the modern world.
Yeah. Let's broaden it now. How is Australia an older adolescent society? See, part of adolescence is a sense of grievance every day. There's a lot of grievance in Australia at the moment, isn't there?
That's true, but I don't think that's unique. I think that is a broader cultural current that's going right across the West in terms of grievance politics. It might, you know, sometimes it's called identity politics. There's certainly an overlap. There's a huge emotional undercurrent in modern politics, and that's why a lot of trends we can't entirely explain. You know, so much of it is about subjective emotional states. And this is where, I know our conversation is not necessarily about Trump, but one of the biggest failures...
Yeah, thank goodness. Just one conversation this year we'll make not about Donald Trump, as endlessly entertaining as he can be.
But commentary, I think one of the big failures in commentary was the failure to bring in primitive collective psychology. I think we have this sort of myth where these rational actors, both sides of politics, and I think that's what we see, the undercurrent of so many of our politics now.
Yeah. How does this sense of a therapeutic culture undermine our sense of national identity?
So this idea of a therapeutic culture really comes over, say, the last half century. You know, the big writers on this, say, Christopher Lash and those types of thinkers, really talking about increasingly how we don't look to God or other institutions for our salvation or our fulfillment. We look for it within the self, and we look for it in a kind of psychic salvation. Hmm. We're looking for fulfillment, we're looking for self-esteem, we're looking for some version of happiness, and we look for it in almost a narrow way in terms of our thoughts, in terms of our individual patterns, how we think of our own personality. Now, that obviously has a lot of power, but that also has great limitations because it's almost divorced from a wider moral order or our relationships to other individuals. Now, that's not how true or sophisticated psychology would look at the human being, but those type of currents are driving a lot of behaviours now, where a lot of people come to me for their type of psychic salvation, if you like, in the therapy room, and all sorts of internal politics or worldviews or value systems come to the consulting room, whereas previously they may have been channeled more collectively. Yeah,
you have this great phrase where you talk about the gentrification of disability. What is the gentrification of disability?
I think this is a very important point. I think there are some unique features here with the broader therapeutic currents that go across the Western world and beyond the Western world too. Now, Australia is also affected by that, but we have these extra things. Now, arguments about disability, neurodiversity, they are also global. But we also have the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And I think that's hypercharged a little, some of these debates around disability. And it's beyond health debates or monetary debates. It's deeply cultural. And I see this in my work. Lots of my colleagues would see it, where there's such an intense demand for particular diagnosis, particularly autism and ADHD. These are fascinating trends from a cultural level. Yes, there's specific disorders, but the rates of these have especially gone up in Australia. We have amongst the highest autism diagnosis. And I find ADHD a fascinating part of this, Andrew. And I'm speaking very culturally. And I find it fascinating that at a time when people often lack spiritual or religious language to explain their lives, sometimes they seek this diagnosis as almost some sort of solace, some sort of, it's not an explanation, but it gives them some sort of relief to what's gone wrong in their life.
But is there not an authentic diagnosis, though, of attention deficit disorder? We're not undermining that,
absolutely.
That's a real thing.
Absolutely. There aren't too many psychiatric diagnoses people seek and want, but ADHD and autism are. And I think one way to think of it is we live in a secular meritocracy. In a secular meritocracy, performance and achievement and where you are almost acquires a greater moral dimension. So suddenly in that type of society, underperformance carries a moral dimension. Mm. And this is where I think there's an element of these diagnoses that seek to, I guess, dilute that moral dimension.
Mm. You quote the American writer David Brooks, where he says, pessimism has become a membership badge. This doesn't automatically relate to medical diagnosis, but what's the identity that people fashion around being pessimistic about the world? And very often people are very comfortable means. We're talking upper middle class people, but it's a kind of performative pessimism. What's that identity that people seek?
It's a curious one, isn't it? We talked earlier about religion and having these markers of identity. So increasingly there seems to be almost a status. We do almost live in a society where you proclaim some sort of pain. And sometimes that's part of the vying for resources in the political space. Autism's a great one where you've got people, they're in group homes with severe disability, but then you've got people like Steve Jobs and Richard Branson relaying claim. And I think it overlaps with the Asperger's diagnosis, which was meant to be a milder form of autism in the 90s. Remember Steven Spielberg came out. It links to neurodiversity movements where it's partly a signal that, yes, you might think I'm a bit annoying, I'm a little bit odd, and that I have some dysfunction, but I'm also a bit brilliant, but you just can't quite see it. And this is what I mean by the gentrification of disability.
Tanvir, thanks for coming back to the program.
Absolute pleasure.
And Dr. Tanvir Ahmed's essay appears in the forthcoming book, Beneath the Southern Cross, published by Connor Court.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.